You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now with the second part of our special documentary, Chile, Promise of Freedom. It commemorates the 30th anniversary of the U.S.-led coup, which overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende and installed as dictator General Augusto Pinochet.
Until the 1973 coup, Chile had experienced a period of uninterrupted political democracy longer than any other Latin American country. Under the Popular Unity government, the country saw a renaissance of cultural activity and political participation. This was in stark contrast to the repression, brutality, and destruction of democratic institutions that began with the coup on September 11, 1973, and which was to continue for 17 years.
Life went on slowly. We went back to work. Slowly things start to look normal.
Isabel Allende, author and journalist, stayed in Chile for about a year following the military coup.
There was absolute censorship in the press and in all the media. So we only heard about what was happening by rumors and by what we could see ourselves in the streets. I had many leftist friends, and I'm from Allende's family. I was not involved in politics or in the government at the time, but I was a journalist and I knew more or less what was going on because I had many connections. At the beginning, people didn't quite believe the rumors of torture and killing and the extent of it. Then we sort of started getting used to the idea. And I found myself talking about torture at breakfast in front of my children. Repression became something normal that one had to live with. We were going crazy that we couldn't live like this. We couldn't live in a place where torture and killing and torturing children in front of their parents, assassinating people, making people disappear, was normal. Where not having freedom was normal. We had to fight back. We had to tell the world what was going on.
The resistance in Chile had begun soon after the coup and grew, though not without great pain. Isabel Allende.
The police would not come in uniform. Very seldom it was the soldiers who did it. It was the secret police who came in civilian clothes and in unmarked cars. And they would arrest someone, and the person would start shouting his or her name so that people will know that that person in particular was missing. I knew of people who had been tortured. I interviewed several. I saw the scars. I saw the trauma, the psychological trauma, the terror. I had to hide people also in my house and then try to place them in embassies. It wasn't easy. It was a hard time. But it was also a time of solidarity, a time in which I realized that for every torturer, there were 1,000 Chileans willing to help. For every person that was going to pick up the phone and tell on somebody else and have that person arrested, there would be 5 willing to hide that person. It was a time when the worst and the best came to the surface. People who were very outspoken leaders went into hiding, and people who were quiet priests or quiet workers that no one had ever noticed before became heroes. When we had the military coup, the repression first hit the artists, the journalists and the intellectuals. Those were the enemies of the process of the dictatorship. Because, of course, those were the people that you cannot put in a cage, the people whose minds you can't control. And they are the ones who sort of express the voice of the people.
Of course, they tried to wipe this movement out by killing the artists, by censorship.
Joan Jara is a dancer and choreographer. Her husband, Victor Jara, was murdered by the military during the coup.
But during the military government, in spite of everything, in the clandestinity, there was this tremendous desire for this type of artistic expression. But people found like new language to express themselves, avoiding the censorship by using metaphors.
El humano está formado.
It was a time, I think, when theatre became even stronger than the music.
I was thinking of leaving Chile by 1974, when I realized that I couldn't live in a state of terror, that I didn't want my children to grow up there. And I was beginning to think that it would last much longer than I had expected. Then by the end of 1974, I had been involved in many things that were considered illegal by the dictatorship. And I was feeling more and more scared. I felt that the circle of repression was closing around me. Then from two different people, I heard that I was going to be arrested. I went into hiding into somebody else's house, but then I started fearing that if they caught me, something might happen to my children or whatever, and then I decided to leave in a matter of a week.
The years that followed were among the darkest in Chile as the junta consolidated its hold on Chilean society and extended its reach even beyond Chile's borders.
Operación Cóndor was created by the Chileans.
Isabel Letelier, human rights activist, writer, and sculptor.
A colonel called Colonel Contreras, he had the big idea of getting together the secret polices of the countries around Chile that had military governments. It was Argentina and Brazil in Bolivia and Uruguay and Paraguay. And they all together share information through computers. They would arrest people in one country and torture him in another country, or just send an information that such and such person should be eliminated in a different country. It was done with the knowledge of the FBI and the CIA. They had information about the operations, and they sponsored the operations. They collaborated in the work of Cóndor. I guess the Cóndor operation was terminated when DINA, the Chilean secret police, killed Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. under the orders of General Pinochet, an American citizen, killed him with a bomb. The CIA and the FBI and the American government felt that they had gone too far, that it was all right if they had these operations of killing away in the Southern Cone, but coming to Washington, D.C. was a travesty. So Operación Cóndor was terminated.
The precision of the assassination of Orlando Letelier revealed the lengths to which the junta would go to rid itself of dissent. Before his death, Orlando Letelier had called for a return to democracy in Chile and had, like Salvador Allende, espoused Chile's right to benefit from its own natural resources. Many opponents of the military regime believed the purpose of the coup and the support the United States gave the Chilean generals was to open a way for foreign capital once again.
There was a lesson that was being taught to us.
Ariel Dorfman, Chilean novelist and essayist.
And if you look at what happened in the next 25 years, what the after effects of that coup and everything surrounding it, the repression, the shock therapy, and the torture, the exile, the mass murders that happened, the genocide that happened in the rest of Latin America. If you look at what happened, you will see that it was fundamentally a way of integrating Chile and Latin America into the global marketplace. It was a way of making these countries absolutely ready for foreign capital that could be invested. And that's what we saw. But of course, what we saw also is that the foreign capital was invested, but most of the benefits were not given to our people, but ended up in banks in the United States and elsewhere.
In the years following the military coup in Chile, the community of Chilean exiles grew in the United States, in Europe, in Latin America. It was populated by workers, students, professionals, and intellectuals who told of their experiences. Some ventured back, others could not. Isabel Allende.
When I left, I lived in Venezuela for 13 years, and I did not return to Chile because things had not changed in Chile in that time. They had gotten worse. Repression was more organized, more efficient than before. So I didn't return. But in 1988, we had a plebiscite in Chile, in which the government offered the population the possibility to choose between Pinochet for another 8 years or some kind of democratic government. And Pinochet, that had all the propaganda machine in his hands, lost the plebiscite. At that point, I returned to Chile for the first time, for a week only. And then I went back in 89 for the election, and I have been back ever since, at least once or twice a year.
The 1988 plebiscite had a profound effect on many Chileans. It represented both a political as well as a psychological opening.
What happened later, when Pinochet called for a plebiscite, and this plebiscite let people regroup in Chile, because he thought he would win the plebiscite, but he lost it.
René Castro, artist and teacher, was imprisoned by the Chilean military after the coup.
Then the cultural affairs start rebuilding again, because they use this election, this plebiscite, in order to express themselves with music, with posters, with paintings. It was the beginning of what happened today. Today is absolutely freedom of expression in the country.
The plebiscite was followed 1 year later by Chile's first democratic election in nearly two decades. Christian Democrat Patricio Aylwin, presidential candidate of a coalition of 17 political parties, received an absolute majority.
It was a very interesting time because you still could feel the sense of caution and fear for many years after the election, even halfway through the next 6 years of the first democratically elected president, Patricio Aylwin, we could still feel how cautious the press was, how people feared the military, how there was this idea that if anything happened, the military would take over again. So it has taken a long time for the country to feel like a democracy. And I think that still, one of the sequels of what happened is that many people have the idea that if the truth is known, if the truth is put on the table and we start discussing the dead, the disappeared ones, if we talk about torture, if we talk about the atrocities that were committed, if people come out with their stories and tell them, if we look for the bodies, that will sort of create some kind of repression or reaction from the military, that would hurt democracy. In my opinion, it would only fortify democracy, it would make it stronger.
Coming to terms with the past presents Chileans with a formidable challenge. Though some of Chile's civil institutions have changed, others have not, or still remain under the former regime's influence and control.
We are living the aftermath of a dictatorship.
Ariel Dorfman.
A dictatorship creates terror, creates fear, creates dread. And this dread does not end when the dictator decides to become the commander-in-chief of the army, then doesn't even finish when he decides to leave the commander-in-chief of the army, become senator for life, and keeps all the forms of power that kept him in power in place.
I realized when I went back that nobody wanted to talk about what had happened. And every time I talked about it, it was bad taste. I was sort of isolated because of that. Not only me, I mean, I'm talking about me, but I shouldn't. This is what happened to everybody who returned to Chile. All the exiles and the refugees that returned had the same experience. Even within the family, people didn't want to talk about it. People who had been tortured very seldom talked about what the experience that they had because it was such a humiliating, an awful thing that most of them don't want to talk about it.
The relatives of the disappeared people are still don't know the fate of their loved ones.
Joan Hara.
In the case of so many people, there has been no justice. All the horrors that happened during the military coup and during the whole 19 years of the military government. I mean, the scars of that have never been healed, and they cannot be healed until... It's probably already too late for that, but so many years without knowing, without any sense of justice.
It has changed. The country has been changed.
Isabel Letelier.
After 17 years of military ruling, we recovered democracy, but the truth is that military governments are a little bit like smoking tobacco. I mean, the effects are seen in a long term. We still cannot achieve the understanding of the Chilean citizens that they are the subjects of their history. They are scared still of practicing democracy. They don't believe in politics anymore. Well, that is something that is happening all over the world. They were for 17 years with a very, very strict ruler, and they feel that everything comes from above. They are not doing what they should be doing, organizing. They have forgotten how to organize.
Outside Chile, the international solidarity movement and the movement to defend human rights grew larger and stronger with time. In 1998, a Spanish judge named Baltasar Garzón ordered Pinochet's arrest and extradition to Spain to face charges related to the thousands of political killings and disappearances during his 17-year rule in Chile. While visiting London in 1998, Pinochet was arrested by British police. After spending 500 days under house arrest, Pinochet was released on a technicality and returned to Chile, where he was investigated for various crimes against the Chilean people.
This experience of having him taken prisoner by Scotland Yard and accused of acts of genocide and crimes against humanity and judged in the name of humanity by Spanish judges and English judges in the House of Lords and elsewhere, this experience which then brought him back to Chile, where then he was stripped of his immunity by the Supreme Court, was an act of exorcism and of enormous advance, both for Chile and for the rest of humanity, because Pinochet established the principle of universal jurisdiction for crimes against humanity, meaning that anybody who has committed a crime against humanity can be judged in any place around the world in the name of that humanity.
How does this history of the coup in Chile help us to understand the complexities of today's world?
I think that the United States has never looked at the events in Chile as they really happened.
Isabel Allende.
First of all, the press reported very little and bias. Now, 30 years have passed. There is one or two generations that have never heard the name of Allende or never heard what happened in Chile. Only there are some people who are willing to remember, but most people don't. I remember when I wrote The House of the Spirits and I went in my first book tour, people asked me if I was related to Salvador Allende in Chile. Now nobody asks, because nobody even knows or remembers anything about Chile. We have a very short memory, and we also have very biased information.
I'm incurably optimistic. I always think there's a resurgence of hope everywhere. I mean, as long as one person shouts in the wilderness, I think there's hope.
Ariel Dorfman.
There has been an attempt at further democratization. The judicial system is no longer as corrupt and as dominated by proto-fascist elements as it used to be. Though income has not been redistributed in Chile, there has been an enormous amount of concentration of wealth. And especially in Latin America, there has been an enormous amount of disempowerment of people at the economic, the social, and the political level. Because Latin America is now entering a very different phase in which the neoliberal policies that Pinochet, in fact, was the pioneer of and that have now absolutely failed in Latin America, because these policies have not been able to solve the basic social and economic injustices of the majorities of Latin American citizens, you have a very, very strong possibility of a resurgence of hope all over Latin America. And it is in that context that I think that we may find some hope for some of the ideas that Allende had. Of course, very, very different ideas, but the ideas of social justice continue to remain very, very important.
Going back to my country after all these years, well, it's not an easy task.
René Castro.
Optimism about the new Chile or the Chile we'll find today is in a question mark. We need to have an optimism about how the country will resolve these social issues. And I don't think they're different than 30 years ago. They're the same issues: housing, work, health, and education. It will be difficult for me, because probably the first time I open my voice publicly, I will get a lot of people who will say, oh, René, you're talking about language on the past. This is different now. Now we respect the human rights. We put some generals in jail. Pinochet is sick, old, and dysfunctional, but is still free, never been punished for his crimes. So people will say that, and I need to be prepared for that, because I think the language is the same language, with a different color, but it's the same. So I'm going to go to live in a country who has a Pinochet constitution, running by a democratic coalition, center-left, that is in turmoil today. A country where the young people don't participate, but it's my country, and it's my people.
I will tell a group of young people that it is important to look at history, not only the case of Chile, but many other cases, and realize that one of the strongest emotions in human beings is fear. And out of fear, we do the most awful things. We fear anybody who is from a different religion, a different color, a different language or culture, anybody who dresses differently. We even fear the homeless because they look different. Anything that is not exactly like we want it to be, we are scared of. And in the name of that fear, we become very self-righteous and we start doing awful things to others, the things that we would never want anybody to do to us or our families. And I think that that is why it's so important for young people to be aware of history, to see that what happened before will happen again unless we stop it. I do not think that there is any nation in the world that is free of the possibility of something happening like what happened in Germany or in Chile or in Brazil or anywhere else. The United States is potentially a very fascist country. It's a country where there is a large number of people who are self-righteous, who have weapons, and who are willing to use those weapons to defend what they think is the truth. And they are not ready to hear anybody else's truth. And this is how fascism starts everywhere. It's usually a popular national movement that doesn't allow any space for dissidents. And so I'm always very skeptical and very, very afraid when I see that happening anywhere. But I don't want to be one of the ones that are afraid. I don't want to allow fear to stop me or paralyze me or make me surrender to what I think is not the right thing to do. In my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old now, I have seen the world change for the better. I think that my grandchildren will live in a better world than the world I was born in. I'm an optimist.
The first thing I would do is I would tell them stories.
Ariel Dorfman explains the Chilean experience to those new to this history.
I would tell them stories about the Chilean people. I would tell them stories about people who had never been given the chance to speak and found a chance to speak. I would tell them stories about the landless peasants who had been left outside history, who had been only in history as laborers. I would tell them stories about women who never had kindergartens in their shanty towns. I would tell stories about how people began to read books because books became enormously popular and cheap to read. I would tell stories about what it meant to watch people come out of the poorest areas of Santiago and dance in the streets. And then I would speak to them about Salvador Allende. So I would say to those young, be wary of the fact that today your government, if I'm talking to young American kids, is making the same mistake that governments like that of Nixon in the past did in relation to Chile. And that they should read history, because if you do not understand what you did in the past, then you cannot understand what you need to do in the future.
The days following the coup turned into weeks. The weeks turned into months, then years. Through the use of force and intimidation, the military junta dismantled Chile's democratic institutions and imposed a rule of fear. The people of Chile endured torture, disappearances, exile, and economic hardship in the wake of the September 11th coup. 17 years would pass before Chile would see its promise of freedom. You've been listening to Chile, Promise of Freedom, produced by the Freedom Archives. And Isabel Alegría, Daniel del Solar, Kim Davis, Andres Alegría, Maria Alegría, Claude Marx, and Nina Serrano. We also had help from Cabal Smith at Duke University Radio and Cristiano Paso in Chile, and the generous support of the Paul Robeson Fund. Historical materials are from the collection of the Freedom Archives. For more information and additional audio, contact freedomarchives.org. Thanks for listening. El derecho de vivir, poeta Ho Chi Minh, que golpea de Vietnam a toda la humanidad. Ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal.
Stay tuned to Peace Watch the rest of this week as we remember the more recent September 11th anniversary of the 2001 terrorist attacks here in the U.S. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance today from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Reem Kathuta and Joya Jefferson-Nuri. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. But it's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.